From the Blue Ridge Mountains to the Chesapeake Bay, Virginia is a mecca for outdoor travel and adventure. Virginia Outdoor Adventures podcast is the ultimate guide for local outdoor recreation, including hiking, camping, kayaking, and so much more. Get the information and the inspiration to plan your own adventure right here in Virginia. I'm your host, Jessica Bowser. Referred to by hikers as the Green Tunnel, the Appalachian National Scenic Trail is the oldest and most iconic multi-state long-distance footpath. But the trail that we know today is not the trail that originally traversed Southwest Virginia. Historian and lifelong hiker Mills Kelly tells the story of Virginia's lost Appalachian Trail and the communities impacted by the trail's relocation. Mills also shares the contributions hikers make to the towns along the trail, surprising facts about trail use today and how it has changed over the last century, and advice for any thru-hiker, section hiker, or day hiker planning to join the 3 to 4 million users who set foot on the Appalachian Trail each year. Let's go! Virginia Outdoor Adventures is sponsored by Breaks Interstate Park. Breathtaking views, towering cliffs, roaring rivers, unlimited adventure. Discover the rugged beauty of Breaks Park, home of the Grand Canyon of the South. From rock climbing to mountain biking, elk tours to canyon rim zip lining, your adventure awaits at the Breaks. Book your 2023 elk tour today. Click on Breaks Interstate Park in your show notes to visit breakspark.com. Blue Ridge Outdoors Magazine takes readers deep into the mountains, covering adventure, recreation, travel, and culture. The largest free, independent outdoor lifestyle magazine in the country, Blue Ridge Outdoors is dedicated to inspiring people in the Blue Ridge and beyond to go outside and play. Every issue includes coverage of top scenic destinations, multi-sport spotlights, interviews with inspiring adventurers, new gear reviews, and features on regional music and culture. Check out Blue Ridge Outdoors Magazine on newsstands monthly or click the link in your show notes to visit BlueRidgeOutdoors.com. Mills, welcome to Virginia Outdoor Adventures.
Thanks, Jessica. It's really great to be here. I'm such a huge fan of your show.
And I'm a huge fan of your show, the Green Tunnel Podcast. When did you first fall in love with the Appalachian Trail?
Boy, you know, I fell in love with the trail a very long time ago. So this is going to age me, but I was a Boy Scout. I was, 11 or 12 years old. And so that was in the early 1970s. So it's been 50 years.
I think we need to address the elephant in the room. I get comments from listeners all the time about how to pronounce this word. So what do you say about the correct pronunciation of Appalachian?
I say it. There is an absolute correct pronunciation, and it entirely depends on where you are. So if you are south of the Potomac River, or at least south of Shenandoah National Park, so south of Waynesboro, then it is Appalachian. Absolutely. If you're north of the Potomac River, almost nobody says Appalachian. The people who live in the Appalachian Mountains north of the Potomac say Appalachian. Now, I'm originally from Franklin County, Virginia, so there it's very much Appalachian. But I moved to Northern Virginia when I was a kid, and here in Northern Virginia, everybody says Appalachian, or almost everybody. So it really depends on where you are.
How much of the Appalachian Trail is in Virginia, and have you hiked all of it?
So the single largest portion of the trail is in Virginia. It's around 25% of the total of almost 2,200 miles is in Virginia. So it is for sure the longest stretch of trail in any of the states by a big measure. I have not hiked all of the trail in Virginia. I'm a section hiker, and I have sections kind of spread out all over the trail from one end to the other. I have in Virginia, I've hiked, I would say probably 2/3.
That's still pretty good. That's impressive for how long the mileage is here in Virginia.
It's well over 500 miles in Virginia.
Yeah, that's a lot. I wonder how many people realize how much of the trail we have here in Virginia. I mean, other states just have tiny pieces and we have this huge distance.
Well, certainly the long distance hikers, they know because they feel like they spend forever in Virginia. They even call it the Virginia Blues. But, I think day hikers and short segment hikers probably don't even realize how much of the trail is in our state.
Right, which is why I want to focus on just that portion here in Virginia. What are some of the highlights or iconic locations of the trail in Virginia?
So for sure, the most iconic location of the Appalachian Trail, I guess I should say Appalachian because it's in that part of the state, is McAfee Knob outside of Roanoke. And I know you've covered that in your show before. And it's just this absolutely beautiful promontory out over the Catawba Valley. And everybody wants to have their picture taken there. I don't advise standing out on the edge. It's not really all that safe, just saying. But that is such a beautiful spot. And it is for sure the most photographed place on the entire trail from one end to the other. But right close to that is also just north of McAfee Knob or Tinker Cliffs, which is also just a really, really beautiful spot. And then south of there is Dragon's Tooth, just, I don't know, 15, 20 miles south. And this is actually known as the Triple Crown of the Trail in Virginia. You know, another really iconic location for AT hikers is in Northern Virginia between Paris, Virginia, and Route 7 in Snickers Gap. And that's called the Roller Coaster. And it's just a section of the trail for about 15 or so miles. It just goes up and down and up and down and up and down. If you're a long distance hiker and you're in really good shape, it's not difficult. If you're a weekend hiker or a day hiker, it's a challenging section of trail and people really enjoy hiking it.
I hear a lot about that section of trail. I also hear a lot about the area that goes through Grayson Highlands and the recreation area up there.
Yeah, that was the third one on my list. I wasn't sure how many iconic locations you wanted because the state's so big, but you know, the section through the Grayson Highlands is really popular. I think it's the most beautiful part of the trail in the whole state. And it's, you know, goes up onto Mount Rogers, the highest point in the whole state. And that whole section there is just beautiful. I mean, in some ways it feels a little bit, there's spots where you feel like you're walking in like Northern Scotland because it's, you know, it's rugged and kind of heather covered hilltops. And that whole Grayson Highlands area is just spectacular.
I agree. It's beautiful. Could you tell us who or what was located on the land where the trail is now located?
Yeah, that's a really great question because who was originally located on that land, of course, is the indigenous population of Virginia. And in the southwestern part of the state, that would be Cherokee people, and then a variety of nations or tribes in the northern part of the state. And many of the trails that we walk on in the state were originally indigenous trails. Indigenous trails didn't tend to go over mountain summits, but as so many hiking trails do today, but instead skirted summits. You know, those trails were developed hundreds and hundreds of years ago. And then when settlers moved into the mountains and pushed the indigenous people out, they often adopted those indigenous trails as trails for their own use and eventually for putting in roads because, you know, the Cherokee or whoever in Northern Virginia or the northern half of the state had chosen those routes really carefully. And so if you're going to put in a road to your farm up on the mountain, then why not choose one that has been around for hundreds of years? And so that gets to then the second population of the mountains, which was really a population of small farmers, people, it's people often say subsistence farmers, but a lot of the farmers in the mountains were not subsistence farmers. They were, you know, they were farming for a market. So the people who lived in the mountains for the last 150 years or so were, you know, really industrious farmers and depended heavily on what they could find in the mountains, especially chestnuts and the chestnut trees themselves before they all died in the 20s. And so, but then by the time the Appalachian Trail came around, that rural population in the mountains had really begun to move out of the mountains, in part because of the collapse of the chestnut tree population.
We're going to get to your book in just a moment, but there was something I read in your book that I thought was really fascinating. I had heard that in the past, the indigenous people created trails to get from, I guess, one community to another or to travel far distances. And I knew that some of those footpaths we still use today, I didn't realize that some of them had become roads. And did you say in your book that the Blue Ridge Parkway is one of those?
Well, sort of. I mean, you know, nobody's done the archaeological work to demonstrate this for sure, but the Blue Ridge Parkway south of Roanoke, it runs along the sort of the edge of the Great Escarpment of southwestern Virginia. And, you know, if you've been there, it's a really just such a beautiful part of the parkway. And the parkway is built on what was known as the Ridge Road in the 1920s and the 1930s. Before that, it was often called either the Philadelphia Road or the Carolina Road because it ran from the markets in Carolina up into, in North Carolina, up into the marketplace in Philadelphia. And, you know, this was just like an old wagon tote road that wouldn't have been any fun to ride on because it was probably corduroyed with logs. But it was laid down. The accounts that I read said that that road was laid down on what had been a Cherokee path and then later became this old Carolina Road and then later the Ridge Road and now the Blue Ridge Parkway.
How has the trail changed over the decades or use of the trail changed over the decades?
Well, you know, when the trail was first created, it was intended to be a recreational trail for people who lived in the big cities of the East Coast. You know, this is in the 1920s, and it was immediate post-World War I, post-influenza pandemic, and at a time of really rapid industrialization in the United States. And those cities were loud, crowded, filled with disease. Industrial employment was really dangerous. And Benton McKay, the person who dreamed up the Appalachian Trail in the first place, really wanted this trail to be a place where those who lived in the cities, whether they were doing industrial work or, you know, just office work or retail work, that sort of thing, people who didn't have other kinds of recreational opportunities, like a weekend house at the lake or something, he wanted them to have a place to just go and be in the forest for a few hours or even overnight and get some fresh air. And so he talked a lot about the importance of getting oxygen. And, you know, this is really forward thinking in the 1920s. And so that was the original plan for the Appalachian Trail. And I'm happy to say that's still how it's primarily used. So the vast, vast, vast majority of people who spend any time on the Appalachian Trail probably spend 2 or 3 hours and, you know, maybe 4 or 5, but less than a day. They don't spend the night. They, you know, drive up to the trail, they get out of their car, they take a nice hike, they go back to their car and they go home. That's exactly what it was intended for in the first place. What's changed over time is that backpacking has gotten more and more popular as gear has become better and lighter. And so that's made those innovations in backpacking technology have made the mountains and long distance backpacking trails more inviting to more people. And so the single biggest change in the trail over time is the proportion of people who are backpackers spending time on the trail.
Camping season is back, and I'm ready to hit the trails in my brand new camping hammock by Hennessy Hammock. Hennessy offers a variety of camping hammock sizes and styles to fit your needs. I opted for the ultralight Backpacker Classic with a unique and innovative bottom entry design that makes it easier for me to get in and out of the hammock, and it prevents those pesky bugs from following me inside. Hennessy also offers the zippered side entry model for those who prefer the traditional style. Every Hennessy hammock features a patented structural ridgeline for easy setup, exceptionally strong suspension ropes, a matching asymmetrical waterproof rainfly, tightly woven mesh to keep even the smallest pests out, high density fabric so mosquitoes won't bite through the hammock, and it even has a gear pocket to hold your phone, light, book, and other belongings inside the hammock. I've tried a lot of camping beds and sleeping options over the years that have been uncomfortable and leave me stiff, tired, and cranky in the morning. With my new Hennessy hammock, all these problems have been solved. I got the best night's sleep outdoors that I've ever had. The light pack weight and easy setup makes this hammock the perfect option for all my camping and backpacking needs. It's no wonder Hennessy hammocks are called the coolest tent in the world. Ready for your best night under the stars? Click on Hennessy Hammock in the show notes of your listening app to visit HennessyHammock.com. Let's talk about your book, which is Virginia's Lost Appalachian Trail. I just finished reading it, and Mills, I absolutely love it. It was so fascinating to learn about the history of a portion of the trail that was located in a different part of Virginia that later was moved. Tell us about your new book and what's it about. Really, I want to know what inspired you to write it.
Well, first of all, I'm really glad you enjoyed it. That's always great to hear, so thank you. This is a classic example of what I warn my students about all the time, you know, when I teach history classes at George Mason University, I tell them that archives are really dangerous places because archives are filled with rabbit holes. And what I mean by that is sort of like Alice in Wonderland, you know, she sees the rabbit jump down the hole and she stands at the edge and wonders, should I jump in or not? Most of the time when a rabbit hole opens up in front of us in the archive, you know, something that looks really interesting and really distracting and not what we were there to work on, when that rabbit hole opens up in front of us, most of the time we turn around and walk away because we have to stay focused on what we were doing. What happened to me was I was working in the archives of the Appalachian Trail Conservancy, and I found this letter from 1928 or 1929 from a guy in Floyd, Virginia, to Myron Avery, the chairman of the Appalachian Trail Conference in those days, now Conservancy, talking about the potential route for the trail along the boundary between Floyd and Franklin counties. And I thought to myself, the trail doesn't go that way. And I know it doesn't go that way because, as I mentioned, I'm from Franklin County originally. And so I would have known about that because it would have just come up in my other research. And I probably would have gone and hiked the section in the place that I was originally from. And so I started looking at that. So there's my rabbit hole, that letter. And I started looking at it and thinking, this doesn't make any sense because the trail doesn't go there. And I looked at some trail maps from the 60s. No, it didn't go there. But I found a trail map from the 30s, and sure enough, the trail took an entirely different route between Roanoke and Damascus on the Tennessee border from 1930 to 1952. It took this entirely different route from the one that it takes today. And so that's what pulled me into the story in the first place.
So explain where this old trail was located and then compare it to where it is today so that listeners have an understanding of the areas we're talking about.
Sure. So if you visualize the kind of southwestern third of the state with Roanoke at the top of that space that you're visualizing, I'm going to start with where the trail goes now. If you're hiking south from Roanoke, and of course you're going to hike over McAfee Knob because, as I said earlier, it's this incredibly beautiful spot, great place to get your photo taken. As you head south, the trail, you head south from McAfee Knob, you come to a highway, and then the trail begins to veer off to the southwest and toward Parrisburg, and it passes Dragon's Tooth and eventually gets to Parrisburg, and then goes south kind of just a little west of Blacksburg, and then cuts down through the Grayson Islands and goes to Damascus. From 1930 to 1952, so when the trail was first being created, right after it crossed McAfee Knob and you get to that highway, it took a sharp left turn on that highway and went downhill and due south. So straight south from Roanoke, crossed over Poor Mountain and down into this great plateau of southwestern Virginia, and then ran along that old roadbed because the Blue Ridge Parkway hadn't been created yet, ran along that old roadbed along the edge of the Great Escarpment, dropped into the Dan River Gorge, which hikers described as the second most difficult part of the entire trail, and then popped back up out of the gorge, crossed very briefly into North Carolina for about 5 miles, then came back into Virginia and ran right down the middle of Galax, which at the time was a big furniture manufacturing town, crossed over the New River, not at Parrisburg, 50 miles away, but at the little town of Freeze, spelled F-R-I-E-S, just north of Freeze, on a cute little ferry that somebody would pull you across the river. And then it ran along Iron Mountain all the way down to Damascus. So that section on Iron Mountain, which is just north of the Grayson Highlands, that section you can still hike really easily because it's the Iron Mountain Trail today.
I think that's really interesting because these two trails are nowhere near each other. They're pretty far apart. So why did they relocate it to where it is today?
Yeah, they're 50 miles apart in some places, and so which is a big difference. And I'll say the part that was relocated, they abandoned 300 miles of the trail, which at the time was 15% of the whole trail. The reason that they relocated, there's sort of two main reasons. One is that the Appalachian Trail is run still today, even though it's a national park now, still maintained and taken care of and, you know, kept open by volunteer trail clubs. And like I'm a member of the Potomac Appalachian Trail Club here in Northern Virginia. There's the Roanoke Appalachian Trail Club in Roanoke, et cetera. They had a really hard time in the 1930s and the 1940s establishing a trail club in that part of the state that would hold together. The trail clubs kind of came and then fell apart and then started up again and then fell apart. So it was very difficult to keep the trail open in that part of the state because of the lack of a consistent group of volunteers as existed, for instance, in Roanoke. And so the Roanoke Club took care of a good bit of the trail east of the New River. Members of the Potomac Appalachian Trail Club would come down twice a year from the DC area and work on the trail, but that's just not a good way to try to keep a trail open, especially in a fairly wild part of the state. So that was one problem. And then the second thing was that a great opportunity presented itself. And that is that toward the, just before the Second World War, the Jefferson National Forest expanded dramatically. And so there was a possibility of moving the trail onto federal land, which would not only give it protection from development, but it would also provide at least some labor from Forest Service employees who could help keep the trail open and maintained. So it was, one, a problem, they couldn't keep a trail club together, and two, an opportunity to have the trail be on federal land.
One of the things that I thought was so interesting about the timing when all of this happened was World War II really impacted the relocation of the trail, right? Because there weren't people available to do the maintenance. They were all wrapped up in what was going on with the war at the time. And then also, I think there was gas rationing. So just getting to the trail was part of the problem too, right?
Yeah, both of those problems were bad from one end of the trail to the other. A number of the trail clubs just shut down completely during the Second World War, both because of a lack of human power, because membership in these clubs was often 50-50 male, female. But you know, women were working in the war as well, whether taking the place of men in armaments factories or other things like that, or serving in the military themselves. And so there just weren't enough volunteers available, and gas rationing. And the other thing that was hard to come by was rubber for the inner tubes for your tires. And so, because those old inner tube tires used to pop with some regularity. And so a lot of the trail club, or a number of the trail clubs, did close down. The other thing, though, that the advent of the Second World War, it actually postponed the relocation of the trail in southwestern Virginia, because there had been a plan to do it sometime in the early 1940s and to make that move earlier. And the war just made that impossible. So it wasn't until 1952 that they shut down the original part. And then in 1953, the new route was the official route.
I'm sure there's plenty of people who are thinking, so what if the trail relocated? Like, who cares if it went from over there to over here? But to some people, especially those living in the communities along where the old trail was located, they do care. They were impacted by the creation of the trail and then later the relocation of the trail. So can you explain how those communities along the old trail were impacted?
Yeah, well, they really missed out because, you know, in the early days of the trail, as I said earlier, backpacking wasn't such a big deal, but after, you know, beginning in the 1960s, backpacking really takes off as a thing that people do. And so first, you know, dozens and then hundreds and then thousands of hikers start moving up and down the trail with their backpacks on. And where prior to 1952, it was, you know, you could count the number of long distance backpackers who came past your farm or your house. You could probably count them on a couple of hands. But now it is potentially thousands of people. And if you think about what those hikers bring to especially rural communities like southwestern Virginia, you know, they bring economic activity, but I think more importantly, they bring cultural exchange. People from all around the United States, all around the world, really hiking on the Appalachian Trail, meeting people who live in these smaller rural communities and, you know, bringing stories of wherever they're from, but also learning about the culture of, you know, the mountain communities in Virginia. And so it's really a two-way exchange. And so they miss out on that. And, you know, that Great Plateau of Southwest Virginia is one of the more rural parts of the state. And it's not isolated, but it is rural. You know, like Floyd County has one traffic light in the whole county, right in downtown Floyd. And so to have people from around the world coming through your community, it's just a tremendous benefit. And so I would say talking to a lot of people in that part of the state, there is a sense of like something was taken away from them.
I think some of the more interesting stories in your book talk about the reactions of the folks in the communities when these backpackers started showing up, because they had never seen anything like this before. And here were these folks with these huge packs on their back. I thought it was funny that they were afraid of men who had long beards or men who hadn't shaved. And they were so fascinated that they, you know, the newspaper people would come out and write up stories and want to interview them. And they were just sort of dumbfounded about why somebody would be walking from Georgia all the way to Maine.
Yeah, I love the part about the beards, because today, if you meet your average Appalachian Trail backpacker who is male, that person probably has a beard. But one of the people I spoke to near Freeze told me that her father had always warned her to stay away from men with beards because they were either, as he put it, hobos or communists. And so bad news, you know. And today, that's kind of like everybody who's been on the trail, every male who's been on the trail for more than 3 days.
Right. So why does the history of the Appalachian Trail matter?
Well, I think it matters for the same reason that the history of anything matters. And, you know, we live in a society that's so focused on the now. And sometimes we forget that the things that are part of our lives have a real history, and it's an important history to understand. So, for instance, you know, like I mentioned that the trail clubs in their early days were 50-50. Many of them actually had 50-50 rules about male and female participation. And the reason for that was that in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, so many more women wanted to be members of the trail clubs than men. And we, you know, when we think about, you know, sort of physical activity like backpacking in the mountains, the easy conclusion to jump to is, that's a male thing. And you know, that's the thing that men did and or do. And, you know, back in the day. And this is simply not true. And so understanding the history in all of its richness and sometimes, you know, unpleasantness, because, you know, the Appalachian Trail passed through many segregated states and some of the trail clubs were formerly segregated. And so, you know, it wasn't a place that people of color felt comfortable really until the last few decades. So understanding those things, I think, is really important to understanding anything that we love.
I will tell you, I just got back from a road trip in Southwest Virginia, and I just happened to be in this area where the old trail was. So I was on my way to Fairystone State Park, and I stopped in Floyd, and I rode my bike on the New River Trail. So I rode past Freeze and Galax, several other communities that are mentioned in the book. And it took on a whole different meaning to me, because I was reading your book while I was on this trip. And even though I've been in these areas before, I didn't understand the history of them, right? I wasn't familiar with the history of them. And as I was reading your book, I was learning things about these communities, what the history of the economy was there, how the people settled there, how they earned a living for many years, and when certain industries left, how they were struggling and in a lot of ways are still struggling today. And it just took on a completely different meaning to me. Now I could pass through these towns and talk to people and have some sense of what the community is like, what the history is like, what's important to those people. And I think for a lot of folks who are visiting that area for the first time, having that knowledge, that background, that understanding, not only does it help us connect with other people, but it helps us understand what it means to be a Virginian.
Did you know that you can become a member of Virginia Outdoor Adventures? For the same price as a cup of coffee once a month, you can receive a Virginia Outdoor Adventures membership while supporting the show. Members have access to the complete list of links and resources from each episode. Members also receive Virginia Outdoor Adventures vinyl stickers and a shout out on the show. If you're enjoying this podcast, please consider supporting me. Hit pause on your podcast player, go to your show notes, and click on Buy Me a Coffee, where you can buy me a virtual coffee or sign up for a membership. My sincere gratitude for the newest members of Virginia Outdoor Adventures, Kimberly from Arlington, Ron from Bowling Green, Musa from Fairfax, Lori from Hopewell, Kevin from Yorktown, and Jennifer from Falls Church. Thank you so much for your support.
Yeah, you know, the New River Trail is a great example of that exact thing, because the New River Trail is a Rails to Trails initiative, and that old rail line, which came from Pulaski down to Freeze, the reason it went from Pulaski to Freeze along the New River was because there was a huge textile mill in Freeze until the late 80s. And it was a mill town and employed basically everybody in town, worked at the mill or something associated with the mill. And then in the late 80s, it left and eventually was scraped off. And all that's left is the power supply dam there now. So then the rail line got pulled up, and at some point it got converted into a nice trail that you could ride your bike on. And it's a very nice trail. But also the Appalachian Trail ran right next to that trail line from Freeze to Bilsby Dam. And so for a segment of what you were riding your bike on, you were riding right next to where the Appalachian Trail had been.
It's really cool when you ride past these things and you know what the history is. It just, you start to think about the people who lived there at that time and what life must have been like for them. And then you actually meet the people who are the descendants of those folks who are living there now. I just also really want to mention, you are the host of the Green Tunnel podcast, and the last couple of episodes that came out were about this. And I love that you have these sound clips from recordings of conversations that you had with people who are living there today, whose grandparents, you know, were either active in building the trail or who invited hikers in to their homes and who, you know, fed them and put them up at night, and people who introduced you to their entire family and invited you in. It's just, it's so fascinating. I mean, you and I both live in Northern Virginia and we don't experience that every day. It was really wonderful to hear little snippets of those conversations and how welcoming folks still are today and how they really want their story to be heard.
Yeah, it is really important. I have such good friends there now. And I would say the average age of my good friends in that part of the state is probably 75. And Ralph Barnard is just the sweetest man you'll ever meet. And he and his wife Hope is just lovely and wonderful. And they hit Ralph's grandfather maintained the trail in the Dan River Gorge, and Ralph is in his mid 80s now, and he remembers the hikers from when the trail was still functioning in that part of the state. You know, he was a teenager at the time, and so he had great stories about the hikers, and he drove me all around the Kibler Valley there, and they're, you know, it's just like they're just wonderful, wonderful people, and I never would have met them had it not been for researching this book. And the one funny story I'll tell about all that, though, is, you know, I mentioned I'm from Franklin County, although my parents were from Atlanta and Tampa. So I had no roots in Virginia beyond that. And my father taught at Farham College. And so when I mentioned to Ralph that I was, you know, originally from Franklin County, but I moved to Northern Virginia when I was 5, he said, "Oh, you're from here." And I said, "Well, you know, sort of." And he said, "Now you're a Kelly. So are your people from up on Kelly's Knob?" And I said, "No, Ralph, I'm, you know, my family was from Georgia and Florida. And, you know, I spent only 5 years in Farham." He said, "Are you sure you're not related to those Kellys?" And so, and several other people had that exact same conversation with me about, "Well, but you're a Kelly and there's Kelly's Knob and there's the old Kelly store along the Blue Ridge. Are you sure you're not one of those Kellys?" So, and so there's this sense of connectedness there that, as you say, we don't have here in Northern Virginia. And that's what those conversations was about, was exploring the human connections that we share. And I just loved that. It was really wonderful.
Yeah, connections really matter to people. And you also referenced often how stories really matter to people. It helps them understand their place in the world. And as far as, you know, thinking back on the 1930s, that feels like it's a long time ago. We're coming up on, you know, 90 to 100 years. However, there are people alive today who still remember this. So it's really not that long ago.
No, it's not. And, you know, I talked to a woman named Dorothy Shiplett, who's father, Shirley Cole, is the one who laid out the trail east of the New River. And when I talked to Dorothy, she lived in Waynesboro when I was talking to her, and she was like 101 and sharp as a tack. You know, I mean, she could tell me all these stories. It was great. And so, yeah, you're right. It is. It reinforces for me as a historian the incredible importance of talking to people who are much older than you and recording them while they talk.
What a blessing. It's really awesome that you get to do what you get to do, Mills. Let's shift a little bit and talk about the AT today. I would say that the Appalachian Trail is largely thought of as a trail for thru hikers. And I know a lot of folks who are getting ready, if they're not already out there now, they're getting ready to start their thru hikes. Give us some statistics. I mean, how many trail users are actually thru hikers versus day hikers or section hikers?
You know, it's so funny that you say that the trail is thought of as a trail for thru hikers, because I think that's probably true. And it's just not. It's just not. The National Park Service will tell you that somewhere between 3 and 4 million people will set foot on the Appalachian Trail this year. Nobody's counting. These are estimates, of course. And I mean, the trail is 2,200 miles long and there are thousands of access points. So it'd be really hard to know exactly. But the Park Service likes to throw out 3 to 4 million people. A couple thousand of those will be thru hikers, and maybe 3,000, and so they're less than 0.5% of the number of people who set foot on the Appalachian Trail. So really, the story of the Appalachian Trail is not the story of the thru hikers, but we know that story because, first of all, it's an amazing thing to hike 2,200 miles, 2,198 this year, I think. Changes slightly every year, but that's an amazing accomplishment. And people who do that, they write about it. They write books, they write blogs, they have YouTube channels, they have Instagram feeds about their thru hikes. So we know about them, where if you go up and, you know, drive out to Linden, Virginia, hop on the trail on Route 55, hike up to the Manassas Gap Shelter that I maintain, and then turn around and hike back, which is a nice 5 mile loop, and get in your car and drive home, you don't like publish a book about that. You don't write an extended blog post. You don't put it on your YouTube channel, probably. And so we don't know about you, but we do know about the thru hikers. And so they kind of suck up all the media attention, but really the real story of the trail is the story of the person who does that 5 mile loop hike on a Saturday.
For those of us who are just day hikers or even weekend hikers and want to get up there sometime soon, what do hikers need to know before setting foot on the trail?
So I could give a really long answer, but I'll give the shorter answer. The shorter answer is, first of all, almost all sections of the Appalachian Trail are very accessible to the average hiker. There are a few parts that are really difficult, but most of them are not. Meaning, you know, you could pull your car up at a trailhead and go out on a nice hike for several miles in either direction and turn around and come back and have a beautiful experience, you know, see some nature, maybe see some wildlife, and just be at peace for a little while. And it's just not that hard. It's not, you know, it's not nothing because it's a hike in the mountains, but it's not incredibly hard. There are some spots that you would want to check. So for instance, if you decided you wanted to hike through the Three Ridges Wilderness in central Virginia, if you're coming at it from the north, not so bad. If you're coming at it from the south, the hike up the Three Ridges is just hard. So that's the other thing, is check a map before you go.
Do you have any recommendations for resources for finding maps or finding information about the trail before you head out?
Yeah, so all the trail clubs, Potomac Appalachian Trail Club, Natural Bridge Club in Virginia, the Roanoke Club, et cetera, they in concert with the Appalachian Trail Conservancy have published guides to the entire trail from one end to the other, nice little guidebooks. And those have detailed trail instructions, that you wouldn't need a map. You could just follow the text and you'd be okay. But those books also come with a map or maps of the trail sections that you might be hiking on. And, you know, those maps are really well done now. And there are apps for your phone, and I'm a fan of maps, especially for people who aren't doing long distance hikes, because your map never runs out of charge. if you drop it in a creek, it doesn't stop working. And you don't have to sometimes stand on a rock on top of a mountain holding it over your head, hoping to get a signal. And so the maps are produced by you can get them from the Appalachian Trail Conservancy. If you live here in Northern Virginia, you could go to REI and get them. You can order them online. They're really easy to get and they're great.
Great. I'll see if I can find links to those and put them in the show notes so people can find it easily. Mills, what's your best advice for someone who is preparing to hike the AT, either for one day or for multiple days?
Don't go out in shoes that you just bought.
Yes.
That's the first thing. That's the biggest rookie mistake of all, is go to the store, buy some hiking shoes, and then go on a hike in the mountains. That's a guarantee that you'll get one or several blisters. And your hiking experience will not be nearly as fun. The second is always make sure you have plenty of water. And there is water along the trail. That water has to be filtered because Giardia is a real thing and it exists. It's a parasite and it exists in almost all the water sources in Virginia. And my wife had it a number of years ago and it's no fun. And the treatment is also no fun. So bring water or a water filter that you know how to use. And I'm a big fan of insect repellent because it's not the mosquitoes that bother me. We live in the South, so it's chiggers that are really the problem. And then the last thing is make sure you let somebody know where you're going.
I don't know about you, but I have never understood the mummy sleeping bag. Sure, they're designed to be light and warm, but they're restrictive and uncomfortable. There's no ability to move around or regulate body temperature. Wouldn't it be great if sleeping outside could feel like sleeping in your bed at home, even while backpacking? If you agree, you'll be just as excited as I was when I learned about Zen Bivy. The Zen Bivy bed is the first hybrid sleeping bag of its kind that matches a mummy bag in warmth to weight ratio and provides unparalleled versatility. The world's first two-piece sleeping bag, the Zen Bivy sleep systems are built like your bed at home, a sheet below you and a quilt above. This design allows for the most comfortable night's sleep in the backcountry without the constriction from traditional mummy bags. I wanted to try Zen Bivy's unique design, so I ordered the brand new Core Bed, which is Zen Bivy's simplest, softest, and most affordable backpacking bed. The first feature I fell in love with was the super soft fabrics on both the inside and outside of the bed. The quilt feels like it floats above me even when I'm fully clipped in, to give me complete freedom to move around during the night without feeling trapped. I love that the hood is integrated with the sheet to insulate my head and hold the pillow in place. The vast foot box gives my feet plenty of space and can be transformed from mummy shape to a spacious wide mode. The versatile design keeps me warm but also allows me to move around. Zen Bivy beds come in different temperature ratings, sizes, weights, and fill options, so you can choose the bed that best fits your needs for camping, backpacking, and everything in between. On your next adventure, sleep in a bed, not a bag. Discover the world's first hybrid sleeping bag by clicking on Zen Bivy in the show notes of your listening app to visit zenbivy.com. What contribution do hikers bring to the communities along the trail and also vice versa?
Well, this is now that hiking has become so popular, the economic contribution of hikers to communities along the trail has become really big. And there are so many businesses up and down the trail that really depend on the presence of hikers, whether they're day hikers or long distance hikers. So, for instance, I live part time in Linden, Virginia, and at the bottom of the mountain that we're on, Blue Mountain, which is very close to the Appalachian Trail trailhead along Route 55. There are two stores right there in this little tiny crossroads town. They're the only two businesses other than the post office and a Methodist church. And I think maybe a lumber business and that's it. But those two stores, one, which is more of a farmer's market and one, which is more of a convenience store, they get a lot of business from people who've gone out to hike for the day and who then will stop at the farmer's market and pick up some fresh fruit or whatever. And that's a big part of their business. And so the trail and its popularity really helps rural communities from Georgia to Maine to stay prosperous. And then there's that cultural exchange that I talked about before, which is, I think, also really important.
Yeah, the economic output of the outdoor industry and hikers in general is just huge here in Virginia. And these communities, you know, we sometimes call them gateway communities here in Virginia, which means that they're sort of the gateway to the outdoors. It's where people start before they head out, and it's where they come back when they're on their way in. And this is where they're buying their gas, buying their food, maybe even spending the night, you know, grabbing a local craft brew, going to a winery, all those sorts of things. When people spend time in the outdoors, they also spend their money when, you know, nearby. And so that is a huge economic benefit here in Virginia. So hikers and are really helping those communities along the trail. Are there concerns about overuse or other conservation issues from all of these people going onto one trail?
So that's a great question. And I'm going to say that I've really had an attitude adjustment about that. And because I was starting to get a little grumpy in 2020 about how many people were on the trail because, you know, when we were quarantined, we had to get outside, and anybody who could found a place not, you know, that was the opposite of their bedroom or their living room. And so the mountains are really the opposite of your bedroom or living room. And so foot traffic on not just the Appalachian Trail, but pretty much every trail you could think of just ballooned. And I wasn't grumpy about the presence of the people. I was grumpy about the fact that some of those people didn't understand leave no trace, and so were leaving trash along the trail, and it was really making me mad. Mm-hmm. And as somebody who cares about that kind of thing, you know, finding plastic water bottles along the trail, I'm never going to forgive anybody who bags up their dog poop and then leaves the green bag full of dog poop next to the trail. Oh, that's where, gosh, I draw the line. That's when I draw the line on that one. I don't care. But I was talking for our podcast. I interviewed a guy named Bryce Esplin, who is the vice president of the Subaru Leave No Trace Foundation. And I asked him about that. And Bryce really set me straight. And I've really changed my view on this as a result of that conversation. So I'm very thankful to him. And that is that he said, you know, we're entering a period of environmental and ecological disaster, and we need every ally we can find to help us and help us protect the environment. And so we need people to get out in the woods. And if they're out in the woods, this is your opportunity to have a conversation with them about taking care of this beautiful place that they are. And so now I welcome everybody. It's really, I have a 180 degree attitude shift about that just in the last couple of years.
Yeah, I can completely relate because I was feeling the same way, especially when I would go to a park and the gate was down because the parking lot was full and, you know, they were at capacity and I couldn't get in. Or I would show up at a trailhead and there were people parking all the way down the road and, you know, all the bad behaviors that we saw. It was very, very frustrating. But we need to get people connected to the outdoors. If we want people to care about conservation and about preserving these natural spaces, then they have to feel that connection. And oftentimes that connection starts young, right? We got to get the kids out there too. So I completely understand how you feel about that and wanting to be welcoming and making sure that people understand how to do it right, like how to recreate responsibly.
And can I just say to anybody who's a listener, who is a parent, and I'm a parent of, you know, now two young men in their 20s, but there's a fabulous book called Last Child in the Woods. And it's, the author is a science writer from California. And it's really about what he calls the nature deficit disorder that children in the United States are experiencing because they're just not getting outside into the woods or the beach or where a lake or wherever. I really, really recommend that book to anybody who has children. It's really thought-provoking.
All right, Mills, we're coming close to the end here. So let's start wrapping it up. But I think people are going to want to know where they can buy your book, Virginia's Lost Appalachian Trail.
So the best place to buy it is on the website of the press, which is Arcadia Publishing. But of course, you can also get it through Amazon.com or, you know, all the online book retailers. But I also will say it's in bookstores up and down the length of the Appalachian Trail now. And so check your local bookstore first and support your local bookstore because, boy, they need it.
Yes, they sure do. Thank you for recommending that. And how can listeners connect with you?
Well, the best way to do that is through our podcast, The Green Tunnel, which is on every podcast platform known to humanity. And just search for Green Tunnel Podcast and you'll find it. So there's that. I'm on Instagram at tkelly7029. That's just the random Instagram, you know, T Kelly was taken. So that's what Instagram suggested and I took it. and it's just, I haven't ever changed it. And if you want to email me, if you have questions about the old trail or just about the history of the Appalachian Trail in general, you know, I'm a professor at George Mason University. So you can email me at tkelly7@gmu.edu. And that's TKELLY7, not EY.
All right. I'll put that in the show notes so people don't make any typo errors when they're searching for you. What's one piece of gear you can't live without?
Rain gear.
Yes.
I can't tell you how many times I've been thankful that I had some kind of rain gear stuffed in my day pack, because if you can whip a rain jacket or a poncho or something on, it just doesn't matter that it's raining. And if you can't, it does matter that it's raining.
Yes. Oh my gosh. I made that mistake just the other day when I was riding on the New River Trail, because the weather was supposed to be sunny and gorgeous all day. And so I left my rain jacket in the cabin. And when I got out there, guess what happened? It started raining. So yeah, and I could have kicked myself. So it's just better to always have it than to not have it. It hardly weighs anything, doesn't take up a lot of space. Like, just have it with you. Mills, what's your next big Virginia outdoor adventure?
Well, it's a toss-up. I have to say I haven't settled yet, but it's going to happen this summer. And it's either I'm going to go kayaking in the Great Dismal Swamp, or I'm going to hike on the AT between Dragon's Tooth, south of Roanoke, and Perrysburg. That's my next big section in Virginia. And I think I might do the kayak in the Dismal Swamp. For one thing, I want to kayak in the Dismal Swamp before alligators make their way into Virginia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
because we're within a decade of that happening, so...
Yeah, I've heard people saying that they've been seeing them in places along the North Carolina border, so I don't think it's going to be much longer.
No.
Yeah. Well, why choose between one and the other? Why not just do both, Mills?
I have two weddings we have to go to this summer.
Oh, you got a busy schedule, huh?
Yeah. My schedule is constrained this year more so than normal.
Yeah. Well, either way, I think you're going to have a wonderful time. I had the best time of my life paddling in Great Dismal Swamp. It's just a magical experience. But hiking the AT can be pretty magical too. So I'm sure you're going to enjoy it either way.
Well, I'm planning on it. That's for sure.
All right. Well, Mills, thank you so much for being a guest on Virginia Outdoor Adventures and sharing some of your, I mean, you have so much knowledge about the history of the Appalachian Trail, and it was wonderful to pick your brain about just a little bit of it. And I hope that folks tune in to the Green Tunnel podcast, because there's so much more information on that. On that podcast about the history of the AT, if they want to learn more. And maybe we'll have you back in the future and you can share some more information about the AT on a different episode.
I would love that. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Mills. Adventure on.
Links and resources from this episode are in the notes section of your listening app and on the website at virginiaoutdooradventures.com. If you enjoyed the show, please consider supporting me. The easiest and most impactful thing you can do is visit buymeacoffee.com/Jessica Bowser, where you can buy me a virtual coffee or sign up for a membership. Members receive access to the full list of show notes, Virginia Outdoor Adventures vinyl stickers, and a shout out on the show. You can also support me by subscribing to the show on your listening app. Help spread the word by sharing the show or your favorite episode with friends or on social media. Last but not least, leave a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts. I love hearing from my listeners. You can find me on Instagram and Facebook at Virginia Outdoor Adventures or on the website virginiaoutdooradventures.com. Thanks for listening. Until next time, adventure on.